Dear brothers and sisters, we are ready to begin our third class. Our speaker is Brother Jason Hensley. The theme for his class this week, or his series, is the beginning of Christ's story. Today's class is entitled Zechariah and Elizabeth. Brother Jason.
Good morning, everyone. If you are wondering why there is a QR code on the slides, it's because that's where you will get access to all the slides. I've been told that sometimes I talk a little quickly, and sometimes I go through the slides quickly. So now you have access to all of it. So I will put them in each day, and you can take a look at the slides from there. Anybody come up with a really good title for this series?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll see. We'll see what you put together. So today we're talking about Zechariah and Elizabeth. As you can see, tomorrow we're also going to talk about Zechariah and Elizabeth. So the incredibly creative title I came up with for tomorrow is Zechariah and Elizabeth Part 2. So that's what we're going to be doing over the next 2 days. That's the plan. Now, as you maybe noticed yesterday, I often like to think in threes for some reason. That's how my brain works. So we're traditionally, typically going to have three sections as we go through this. So first, we're going to talk about Zechariah and Elizabeth's blamelessness. That's going to be the big picture, the setting as we go into this story, the blamelessness. Then we're going to look at the story itself and then the deeper picture that's reflected in it. I'm going to suggest to you that as Luke is inspired to write these things, he is specifically inspired to reflect other stories, to use language that comes from other sections of scripture, so that as we're reading it, that we're thinking about other passages as well. So that's what we're going to see in this deeper picture place. Now, main message, right? We talked about this yesterday. There's always a main message so that if you get distracted or anything along those lines, you can always return to that. And because it's day one, I made it easy. It's three words. Grace changes things. That's the big point. That's the big point of this class. That's the big point of this series. It is that grace is the big deal. We are going to see grace entering into the world and shattering history, changing the direction that everything is going. Grace changes things. And that's a big deal. Now, you'll also notice that I have a why question there. And that's because, well, originally it was because having four children, I got asked why a lot. But in addition to that, I just started to enjoy that. I think asking why is a really fun thing to do when you're reading the Bible. Right? To just go through and say, why does it say that? Why does this person show up in this story? Right? Why are they there? Why did God have it recorded in this way? So I'm always going to give you a little why question to think about. And if you have other why questions that you come up with, come and talk to me about them. I'd love to hear them. I don't know if I'll have any answer at all, but I think it's fun to just ask why and to think about that. So here's our why question. Why was Zechariah made mute for asking a question? Have you ever thought about that? Have you ever felt like that seems a little bit maybe mean or something like that? You know, what's going on? He says, how can this be, right? How is this going to happen? And all of a sudden he's told, you will be mute. Why? Why is it like that? So we're going to start by laying out the foundation. We're going to look first to see how are Zechariah and Elizabeth described to us and how are we supposed to see them as we go through this story. So let's try and jump into their lives here. Now, you'll notice I've underlined two things here at the beginning of the story. And I think those are two things that maybe we skip over these. We miss them. We don't think about them a lot. So it says here in Luke 1:5, in the days of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah of the division of Abijah. He had a wife from the daughters of Aaron. Her name was Elizabeth. Now, we'll talk about that second half later. But we want to just note that since he's a priest, that automatically means he must be a descendant of Aaron, right? But in addition to that, we're given a little bit of detail here that I think we need to dig a little bit deeper to understand what's going on with this. We're told that he's from the division of Abijah. Now, I don't know about you, but as we talked about yesterday, we read this at least two times a year, right? And how many times have you looked at that and thought, oh, okay, and just moved on, right? Like, who even is Abijah? And not only that, and why do we care? right? Why does it say that? Okay, so we want to try and understand a little bit of it. Now, you remember the chapters that when you're reading through them in the readings, you say, oh, kids, I think we'll read the second and the third portion tonight, right? Yeah, it's those, but these have like good value, right? They're, you know, all scripture is given by inspiration of God, it's profitable for, right? So these are scriptures that can help us. And in fact, one of these genealogical records is incredibly helpful. So take a look at this as far as this story goes. It says, 1 Chronicles 24, the first lot fell to Jehoiarib, the second to Jediah, the third to Harim, the fourth to Seorim, the fifth to Malchijah, the sixth to Minjamin, the seventh to Hakoz, the eighth to Abijah. So there's our Abijah. And yet you might be thinking right now, well, that's great. There's Abijah, but I have no idea what this is about, right? Like, this is just a list of names, so this doesn't actually help that much. Well, if you look at the bottom of the screen here, starting at the fourth to the last line where it says these, you'll notice what this is a list of. It says, these had as their appointed duty in their service to come into the house of the Lord according to the procedure established for them by Aaron their father, as the Lord God of Israel had commanded him. So in other words, these are the groups and the families of priests that served, it says, their appointed duty in their service to come into the house of the Lord. So this is, you ready for this? The schedule of the priests, right? It's biblical. So this is the schedule of the priests. Now, why did the priests have a schedule? Aside from the fact that it would have made everybody happy. But the reason that the priests had a schedule is because if you look at Deuteronomy 18, 6 to 7, we're just going to try and play this out. Back in the day when the tabernacle was functioning, if you were a Levite or a priest and you wanted to serve in the tabernacle, the way to do that was very simple. We don't think about this a lot because we don't live back then. So like this doesn't often come into our minds, but it was a really easy procedure. It worked like this. You said, I want to work in the tabernacle. And so you did. Pretty straightforward. Now that meant that you'd be living in a Levitical city somewhere in Israel and you'd have to, as the verse says, you'd have to sojourn, meaning you sell your stuff. You then head to the tabernacle and you're going to survive off of your work at the tabernacle. So that's what you would do. So it wasn't extremely complicated. It just meant you had to be willing to go through a big life change. As time went on though, as you can imagine, families got bigger, right? So the time of the Exodus is right around 1440-ish BCE. So Exodus is around 1440-ish BCE. As time goes on, the centuries pass. When we get to the time of David, right around 1000, so about 500 years later, when we get to the time of David, the families are big, right? It wasn't just the kind of thing where somebody could say, oh, I want to work in the tabernacle, or later on, I want to work in the temple, because there were too many people. So David says, we're going to make a schedule. Right? This is how we're going to do it. We're going to set it up so that we know who's going to do this when. And so that's what we were looking at here. In 1 Chronicles 24, David sets it up so that there's all these different families of the priests, and he organizes it into 24 groups so that each family more or less served for about 2 weeks of the year. Now, just to throw it out there, that's a pretty awesome job, right? I mean, you know, a lot of people are looking at 2 weeks off a year. They had 2 weeks on a year. So that's what they're looking at now. Now, by the way, though, right? Psalm 84, we know they were sad, right? Psalm 42, they were sad when they were not in the temple. So that, you know, you can feel sorry for them, even though they only worked 2 weeks a year. Okay. So you can see that this is how it was set up. It was set up so they had this 2 week a year process. Probably the way that it was split up was similar to how the Levites were split up. If you look at 1 Chronicles 9, you'll notice that they actually serve in 7 day periods. So they probably would serve 1 week in the beginning of the year, 1 week at the end of the year. And that was the division, just like what the Levites did in 1 Chronicles 9. You'll notice that I have a quote here from the Talmud. It says Talmud Sukkah. So the Talmud, I'll just give you a real quick rundown on it. So the Talmud is not a biblical book. So I want to make that very clear. Please do not say Jason Hensley believes in the Talmud or anything like that. I don't. I don't think it's a spiritual book or anything whatsoever. It is a book of Jewish tradition. The way that it came about was it's a bunch of commentary on the Torah, and the Talmud is actually the commentary on the commentary. Just to make that clear, right? So, you know, this is when Jesus says, like, you hold to the tradition of the elders, right? Greater than the commandments of God. Well, like, that's what he's talking about. They had commentary on commentary. And they actually hold this still today. So within, like, conservative and Orthodox Judaism, this is held as inspired, right? This is considered sacred text, the Talmud. And so you'll notice, I'm quoting it here to just understand the traditions. And so this explains that in the traditional sense, what would happen was you'd have priests on for 1 week and the next week's group of priests would come. So that helps us see that even in about the first-ish century, they were still following the same kind of procedure. 1 week on, 1 week off. So we get all of this from the whole Abijah thing. Now, you might be thinking, okay, wow, like that's a lot from the Abijah piece, but there's actually more to it because what we see is that as you go through the record of scripture, you continue to see these courses or these groups of priests come up even to the time of Nehemiah. Now, if we're working chronologically, David organizes the courses or these groups of priests right around 1,000-ish. Time of Nehemiah is significantly closer to about 500. So these groups of priests are still functioning. They're still performing their duties in the temple as David set up 500 years later. But Zechariah is around in the first century, right? So, I mean, it's impressive that these guys could say, yeah, like this is the family I'm from, etc. They could say that in the 500s, but Zechariah could say it 1,000 years later. Now, this is kind of a big deal, right? Like this would be the guy that if you went to him and you were like, so where are you from? He'd be like, oh, I can tell you, right? Like this, you know, it's pretty good. It's high pedigree, right? That Zechariah has. Now, in order to really understand why this matters, we actually need to see the contrast. So take a look at this. This is from Ezra chapter 2. And what we have going on here, these are the exiles coming back in the first wave. Now, the first wave of exiles, you'll notice, look at what some of the priests don't know. And remember, this is right around 500. And Zechariah, 500 years later, knows where he's from. Look at what these guys know. Also, of the sons of the priests, the sons of Habiah, the sons of Hakoz, of the sons of Barzillai, who had taken a wife from the daughters of Barzillai the Gileadite, and was called by their name, these sought their registration among those enrolled in the genealogies. But they were not found there, and so they were excluded from the priesthood as unclean. So in other words, because they couldn't say, here's my genealogy, here's the group that I'm from, the family that I'm from, they were told, sorry, you can't actually be priests. Now remember, that's 500 years before Zechariah. So he still knows the family that he's from. So that's pretty impressive as far as that goes. Now, you might be wondering, okay, that's great, but like, why? Right? In Ezra chapter 2, why was it a big deal for them to not know what family they were from? You know, couldn't they have just said, oh, I'm from the course of this other guy, you know, or something like that? Like, what's the big deal? Well, the reason that this matters is because God had specifically and explicitly said that only some priests would be allowed to continue functioning as priests. Only some priestly families would continue to be allowed. So when you take a look at this, you'll notice in 1 Chronicles 24 verse 3 that it says that you have two branches here. So Aaron had four sons. Do you remember who they were? Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Ithamar. Right? Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, Ithamar. So four sons. Now, when you look at 1 Chronicles 24, verse 3, you see that the priesthood at that time was divided into Eleazar and Ithamar. That's it. Why? Nadab and Abihu weren't around, right? So they served one day as priests, and it didn't go very well. Okay, so we won't get into that. Now, Eli was from the family of Ithamar. So you can trace that genealogy down. You can see where he comes from. Eli was from the family of Ithamar, and God curses that family. You remember what happens there, right? Because they were stealing of the offerings, his sons were sleeping with the women in the tabernacle, etc. So God says, this family is done, right? No more of the tribe of Ithamar. So in other words, the reason that in Ezra chapter 2, priests had to be able to come out and say, hey, this is my course, this is the group that I'm from, was because Ithamar families were not allowed anymore, right? They were kicked out. And so God goes through and he gets rid of them all. Eli's sons are killed, there's a massacre of the priests, etc. And you lose the line of Ithamar. So what that means is that by being able to say, hey, I'm of the course of Abijah, Zechariah is not only displaying, I know a lot about my genealogy, but he's saying, I am a qualified priest. In other words, if you were to try and say anything against him being a priest, you couldn't do it. Right? If you wanted to try and disqualify him somehow, you couldn't. So these were all the things that were required at that point to be a priest. You had to know your genealogy so that you could prove that you were descendant of Eliezer. You had to be a male. You had to be over 20 and under 50, which, by the way, I just want to put out there, I think is interesting in that, oh, this might get me in trouble. Never mind. You all can think about that one. And you had to be unblemished, right? So I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but the priests were good-looking dudes, right? Like, they couldn't have any kind of, like, thing that you'd say, oh, that's not supposed to look like that, or whatever. So, like, not only, like, just think about this guy. Not only does Zechariah know his pedigree, right? But he's like one of those guys that when he walks into the room, people are like, whoa, right? Okay, so this is what we're talking about. This is the guy that you'd look at and you couldn't say anything bad about him, including how he looked, right? You'd be like, man, I can't even say that he's ugly, you know, or something like that. Like, that just, it just wasn't a thing. So that's where he stands. Now, even if you're one of those people who, like, wants to make fun of somebody's name, you can't even do that, right? Like, his name means remembered of Yah, and he's from the division of Abijah, which means my father is Yah, right? Like, he's got God's name stamped all over who he is. So when it comes to this guy, Zechariah, he's real good. Now, when we look at his wife, Elizabeth, you'll notice that she's described as being from the daughters of Aaron. Now, that's interesting because if you were to walk through what the law says, what the Torah says about priests and who they were supposed to marry, you'd find this. They couldn't marry a prostitute. They couldn't marry a defiled woman. They couldn't marry a divorced woman. But other than that, they could marry anybody else as long as they were from the tribes of Israel. Now, I think that's interesting because not only here are we seeing that he had this strong pedigree, right? He was good looking, but like now he's like above and beyond, right? He doesn't just marry anybody, but he marries somebody who's of the daughters of Aaron. Now, just notice what the record is doing here, because I think that this is fascinating. Her name is Elizabeth. Anybody know how to say Elizabeth in Hebrew? Elisheva, yeah, or Elisheva, if you want to be a little more, you know, Hebrewish sounding. So, you'll notice, guess who else married somebody with that name? Aaron, right? I feel like as I was working on this study, it was one of those like, oh, of course, right? As you look at it further, it's like, oh yeah, you know, he just takes it to the next level, right? This is how it works when you're looking at Zechariah. He's that much better. And then you look somewhere, oh, he's even better than that, right? So he marries somebody that's like reflecting the story of Aaron's wife. And not only that, but Aaron marries somebody from the tribe of Judah. And do you remember what kind of connections Elizabeth has? To the tribe of Judah, right? Because she's related to Mary. So not only is Zechariah, not only does he know his genealogy, he's perfect as far as his looks, because that otherwise he'd be disqualified as a priest. But when you look at his wife, she's of the daughters of Aaron. She has the same name as Aaron's wife, and she has the same kind of family connections that Aaron's wife has. Now, that name, by the way, basically means a very similar thing to Zechariah's name, which is my God has sworn, Elisheva. Now, if that wasn't enough, right, if you feel like, oh, you know, you're kind of emphasizing like this like perfection piece a little bit too much, well, consider what the next verse says, right? Can you get a whole lot better than this. I feel like this is kind of like a mic drop verse, right? Like if somebody said this about you, you'd be kind of like, yeah, try and say something better than that, right? I mean, listen to this. They were both righteous before God, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and statutes of the Lord. That's pretty crazy. Now, if it just said one of those things, they were both righteous, that'd be a big deal. But it says they were righteous, they were blameless in everything. Now, anybody know how many commandments Jews say there are today? They counted them up. Oh, you're close. Two of those numbers were right. 613. 613. So, in other words, what this is saying is, if you went to Zechariah and you were like, hey, how about commandment 402? He'd be like, oh yeah, I did that one. In fact, I did it twice yesterday, right? I mean, like, that's the kind of thing that we're looking at, right? It says they were blameless. Like, you could not open up the Torah and say, but you didn't do that, right? There was no way. Now, I think that's fascinating because we know, right, that it isn't possible to fully keep the law. And yet you can see here that scripture is painting this over the top kind of picture of these people, because I think it has this point to make to us that here they are, like the perfect specimen of humanity and of following the law that was given by God. So when you're looking at them, you would be reading these first two verses and you would think, wow, I want to be them. Right? Like, I wish I could be these people, because as you go to the next verse, what does it say? But they had no child because Elizabeth was barren and both were advanced in years. In other words, all of a sudden, the record is like going up, 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 and then it says down, right? And you're supposed to feel this as you read it. You're supposed to say, what? That's not what's supposed to happen. And by the way, I mean that when I say that's not what's supposed to happen. Right? The law literally says that's not what's supposed to happen. It says that there in Leviticus 26 verse 9, I will turn to you and make you fruitful and multiply you and will confirm my covenant with you. Now, just to bring into the historical context a little bit, I think we're aware of this, but back then your retirement plan was your children, right? So you didn't have a pension, 401k, your 401k was your child. So this is what they're trying to figure out. Right? Do you see the tension in the verse? They're old and they don't have a child. So there is nobody to take care of them. This is what they're trying to figure out. And yet the law had repeatedly said that this is what would happen. Now, just by the way, I'm going to bring this out because I think that this is interesting. If you're not into grammar, I apologize. And I just apologize because that means you're probably sad, because grammar is so interesting. Okay. Now, Here's what you need to know. See that you there in Leviticus 26 verse 9, it says, I will turn to you and make you fruitful. Now, that is a plural you. Now, we lose this in English. By the way, if you're reading out of the KJV, you will actually have an advantage here, because the KJV shows you when the you is plural, because it says ye, and it shows you when the you is singular, because it says the. Just as a by the way. Okay. So this is a plural you. So it's saying, I will turn to all of you, each of you as an individual, and I will make you fruitful. Now, not only that, but the law actually covers all of its bases, because when you go to Deuteronomy 28, the blessings and the cursings are actually singular. So in other words, Leviticus is talking to each individual person because it's talking to a plural you, whereas Deuteronomy is talking to the nation as a singular whole. So all bases are covered in that they are told you will be fruitful as a nation and your family itself will be fruitful. So the law emphasizes that if you follow the law, if you do what God has said, you will get all of these blessings. In fact, the blessings will be so abundant. Look at what it says at the end there of Deuteronomy 28 and verse 4. We're going to start where it says, blessed shall be the fruit. Blessed shall be the fruit of your womb, and the fruit of your ground, and the fruit of your cattle, and the increase of your herds, and the young of your flock. Do you see the emphasis there? It's not just like, oh, you'll have a lot of kids. But it's, not only will you have a bunch of kids, but there's going to be so much fruitfulness that you're going to just like have fruitfulness exploding everywhere, right? Your plants will be like growing with a whole bunch of fruit. Your cows will be having babies everywhere. Your chickens are going to be like, you know, multiple eggs every day. Like this is the people would just be like, whoa, like look at all this growth. Look at all this stuff that's happening. And yet what happened? Right? That's what we are supposed to feel when we read Luke 1 verse 7. What happened? Here are people that are not just blameless according to the law, but are above and beyond the law. But what the law promised didn't happen. Why? What's going on? Well, that's where we get into the story and in the next piece here. Now, it's Zechariah's turn as the priest to enter into the temple of the Lord. Just so that you're aware, the word there, temple, is na'on. And that's not our typical word for temple. The typical word is heron. So heron generally means temple. Na'on means the holy place. Right? So it's not just that he's going into the temple, but he's actually going into the holy place. Right? So he's going into the inner sanctuary. Now, what that means is if you take a look at this, you have this rectangular area, right? That's the Temple Mount platform. So that's what's still around today, right? You can go there in Jerusalem. You can walk around on that. Over on the right-hand side, that's what's known as the Court of the Women. So this is how you would enter the temple. You'd go in through the Court of the Women. You'd have those four menorahs there that would be lit during the Feast of Tabernacles. Then you'd walk up those steps and you'd go into what's known as the Court of Israel. And that's where the altar was. If you look really closely, you can maybe see the altar. It's down on the bottom of that section. So the altar was there. The laver was there. And then if you were Zechariah, you would walk up the steps and go into that golden piece, which was the holy place, right? So this is Zechariah's job. Now, again, the Talmud describes for us the elaborate rituals that they put together for the one priest who got chosen. Now, remember, we're in the first century, so this is 1,000 years beyond David. So they added more to the organization because the families had grown even more and more and more. So here's how it went, according to the Talmud. First off, you had to be chosen by lottery because there were so many descendants. So not only was he from the division of Abijah, but he actually got randomly chosen to be the one who would burn the incense. So this was a once in a lifetime kind of moment. So he gets chosen to be the incense guy. Now, there were actually a few different jobs here, just so that we're aware. There was the incense guy, which was Zechariah, and what he got to do, according to the Talmud, was carry a golden spoon. All right? So again, you can see some of the tradition and ritual added here. So he would carry a golden spoon, and he'd walk with the golden spoon, which would have the incense in it. So he'd be carrying that like this. And then you'd have another priest who came along with a shovel. That priest would go to the altar, and he would get the coals from the altar because you had to have something to light the incense. So he'd take the shovel with the coals from the altar, and the two of them would walk together up those steps. And as they walked up those steps, the priest with the shovel would put the coals into a golden bowl, and then he'd throw the shovel on the ground. Now, he had to do that because it would make a big clanging noise, and all the other priests in the temple would run together and wait outside of the holy place for the priest who was lighting the incense, in our case, Zechariah, to come out. So they were waiting outside when they heard that shovel land on the ground. Now, the priest who's lighting the incense would then walk in. He would put the incense in the incense altar, and the other priest, the one who had the shovel, would come in and put the coals on the incense. The one who put the coals on the incense would then run out, and he'd fall down on the ground. The priest who was lighting the incense was therefore left alone in the temple. Now, by the way, in case you think I'm making all of this up, you can check all of this. Now, again, it depends on how accurate historically you think the Talmud is. It's generally considered a somewhat reliable historical source. So you can take a look. Now, what Zechariah's job then would have been is when he was left alone, he was supposed to make sure that the incense spreads, that the incense is burning. And once the incense is burning, he then himself runs out, it says there at the end, and he prostrates himself and emerges from the sanctuary. So just like the other priest, he runs out and he falls on the ground. Now that's an important piece of this story because of what's about to come next. So he's going to run out, he's going to fall on the ground, but as he's lighting the incense, what happens? An angel appears, right? And the angel's standing there on the right-hand side of the altar. So sort of something like this, right? You can see somebody standing there next to the altar, or maybe you can just kind of see a blob. But that's what it is. Now, standing on the right-hand side, or just being on the right-hand side, this generally shows the idea of power or of favor, something along those lines. So that we're explicitly told that the angel was standing there on the right-hand side of the altar, that's interesting to consider with what comes next. Because, let's just remember our context, Zechariah was going to light the altar, and then he was going to run out and fall down on his face. The angel is standing on the right-hand side. The angel then says to him something that completely changes the story, completely changes history. Listen to this. "Do not be afraid, Zechariah, for your prayer has been heard, and your wife Elizabeth will bear you a son." Now you can imagine, right? This is a very exciting moment. Zechariah is really happy about this, and yet what's going to be so surprising is what comes next. The angel says, "And you're going to call his name John." Now, I don't think we think about this all that much in terms of the context here. Remember, Zechariah is righteous, he's blameless according to all the commandments. He is there offering incense, following all the traditions, doing everything that you are supposed to do in basically one of the most important jobs in Judaism, right? This is a big deal. And he's told, call his name John. Now, why does that matter? Well, in the Greek, the word is Ioannin, Ioannin, which is just a transliteration of the Hebrew, Yohanan, Yohanan. Yohanan means Yah is grace. And let that name sink in for a little bit. Right? It's not Yah's grace. It's Yah is grace. Do you feel that? There's like a significant weight in what Gabriel says at that moment that Luke has just set up for us. And that here we are looking at the man who's righteous, blameless, according to all the commandments. He's offering, doing one of the most important things in Judaism, and all of a sudden, an angel appears and says, you're going to have a kid. Why? Because Yah is grace. That's what he's about. And consider what he says next. Did you notice what was missing from the story of Zechariah and Elizabeth? It says they were righteous, they were blameless, they knew their genealogy, all of these wonderful things. But they never had this. And you will have joy and gladness, and many will rejoice at his birth, for he will be great before the Lord. Do you see the grace of God bursting onto the scene? Right, here it is. It's like it had been held back, and here was the law. Here's these people trying to do everything that the law said, trying to go above and beyond, and it couldn't bring what they really needed. And the angel comes and says, Yah is grace. And now you'll have joy and gladness, and so will everyone else. Now, all right. If you're curious about these slides, talk to me about it. We're going to skip those. Now, I think it's interesting that Zechariah asks the question, how shall I know this? For I'm an old man, right? So he asks the question, and the response is, I am Gabriel. I stand in the presence of God. Now, Gabriel, right? That should remind us of Daniel 8 and 9. You can check that, right? This should have made Zechariah think about the coming of Messiah. But in addition to that, notice in the historical context here, he says, I stand in the presence of God. Now, we know this is a phrase connected to angels. But in addition to that, you remember what Zechariah is doing? He's offering the incense, and then what? He runs out, and he falls on the ground. Now, specifically, he's supposed to run out, because there they are in the presence of God, and they're humans, right? So they're just supposed to fall down before him. And yet, here's Gabriel. I stand in God's presence. I was sent to speak to you and bring you this good news. Now, what's fascinating about what happens next, I think, is really drawn out by this contrast that we've seen with the law and grace. Because the Talmud tells us that here's what he does. This is what the incense offerer was supposed to do. The bowl that held the incense was in the hand of one priest, who had burned the incense, and the spoon and its cover were in the hands of one priest, the friend or relative of the one who burned the incense, right? And so that one would run away so that the other one was left alone. The priests placed their vessels on the ground and then blessed the people, reciting the priestly benediction. So in other words, the first one runs out, right? This was the one that carried the bowl. He runs out, falls on his face, so that Zechariah is left alone. Zechariah is supposed to offer the incense, then run out, fall on his face. And when the two of them are there on their faces, they stand up and they say, "The Lord bless you and keep you." Right? Numbers chapter 6. They're supposed to recite the priestly benediction. What happens in this story? He can't. Have you ever thought about that? I think that this is just so cool to see how this goes. Because here's this person who's blameless, perfect according to the law, right? This is how Luke describes him. And yet, he can't bring the blessing. He can't do it, right? It's a very simple procedure. You walk in, light the incense, you fall on your face, you come out, you recite the blessing. You get one chance your whole life to do this. And he can't do it. This is why he's made mute. Now, if that's not enough, the record emphasizes the fact that by being made mute, he also was no longer fit to be a priest. Now, you'll notice it doesn't say muteness on there. But we can actually add, Zechariah was not just mute. What else was he? He was also deaf. How do we know? They make signs to him, right? Verse 62 of Luke chapter 1. Verse 62 of Luke chapter 1, they make signs to him. So not only is he mute, but he's also deaf. In other words, he's disqualified from being a priest. So he does spend the rest of his time working in the temple, probably doing some kind of menial tasks, but he is no longer qualified to be a priest. Now, consider what this all puts together. This was blamelessness under the law. And when the angel says, "Here's what's going to happen," Zechariah says, "How? How can that be?" Blamelessness under the law didn't bring belief. It didn't bring rejoicing. It didn't bring joy. That's what grace would do. All right, we have 4 minutes. Here we go. We're going to talk about the deeper picture. Let's take it to the next level. Ready? I don't know if you noticed, but in this story, I think it was specifically written to reflect Abraham. Listen to how they're described again, walking blamelessly in all the commandments and statutes of the Lord. Now, in Genesis 17, verse 1, God appears to Abraham and he says, "I'm God Almighty, walk before me and be blameless." Now, the word "walk" is not the same in the Septuagint. Just so you're aware, right? I want to be honest about all these things. So the word "walk" is not the same, but I think the sense is very much the same, right? Abraham is told, "Walk before me and be blameless." We're told they were walking blamelessly. The word "blameless" is the same. So there's this sense in which there was a similarity to Abraham. So I'm not saying that being blameless is bad by any means, right? This is important, right? We should strive for this kind of thing, just as Abraham did. You see it again here in the way that Abraham is described in Genesis 26, verse 5. It says, "Abraham obeyed my voice, kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." Same phrase, by the way, that's used to describe what Zechariah and Elizabeth followed, all the commandments and statutes of the Lord. So you can see Abraham reflected in this, and yet it wasn't Abraham's blamelessness that brought him the promises. It was the relationship. It was the connection to God that Abraham had. Once again, you can see it reflected in this phrase too, advanced in years. Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. In fact, the whole story is basically the same. They both pray for a son. The birth is prophesied by an angel. That phrase, "you shall call his name," is exactly the same. "How will I know?" is the same kind of idea. One of the partners does not believe it, and both children circumcised at 8 days were specifically told that. So I think then, by the way, again, you have access to the slides. So I think that's why when Zechariah expresses his excitement here at the birth of John, and also when Mary later talks about the birth or her pregnancy, you have this sense of Abraham reflected in all of this. What we have overarching here is that there's always been two paths that have been offered to come to God. There's been the way of promise and the way of law. It's always been around, even before law, right? You could try and follow according to regulations, traditions. There's always been two ways. And what we're being shown in Luke chapter 1 is that even if you're blameless, even if you tithe mint and anise and cumin, and you do it exactly as you're supposed to, you can very easily forget the weightier matters of the law. Now, I'm not saying that Zechariah did. I don't think he did at all. But the law itself can't bring that life. It can't bring that joy. And so as this story opens up to us, and as we see Zachariah and Elizabeth, we are being shown grace changing the course of history. Grace changes things. And so for each of us, as we consider that principle, the big question becomes, how has grace changed you? How has it changed us? How do we recognize that grace? How do we experience that joy that comes with that grace? How do we as a community show that grace? Because grace changes things. It has to. And thus, you'll notice, I don't think it's an accident, but the very next course after Abijah was the eighth. Do you know what the next one was? It was Joshua. Jesus was going to bring that grace, and things were about to change.